Welcome to My Big Safety Challenge, a podcast all about stories of safety leadership presented by Dale Carnegie and the Board of Certified Safety Professionals.
Jason, you and I have been able to work together with several podcast guests, and there's a lot of anticipation about the opportunity that we have today because we are all in this need of opportunity to influence other people. And I believe we'll have a person that will help us and give us some good insights. Please tell us a little more, Jason.
Yeah, that's right, Merle. Especially excited for today's guest. And I want to open with this before we formally introduce our good friend, Rene Rodriguez. We all have ideas to share with the world. Whether we do that successfully in business and in life depends on getting others not only to listen, but also to act on what we say. That's the power of influence. The capacity to have an effect on an outcome and positively influence change. Have you ever shared a story and no one listened? Told a joke and no one laughed? Pitched a product and no one bought? These are all painful, all too common scenarios that can leave us feeling alone and insignificant because of our inability to influence the world around us. Merle, as you referenced, this particular gentleman not only coaches and teaches others to be able to influence the world around them, but I've seen him do this for the last decade or so, always influencing for the good and giving people the tools to be able to share their story and not only inspire hearts and minds, but most importantly, like we're going to hear from Rene today, is to move feet. So Rene, thank you so much for joining us. Looking forward to this conversation.
It's an honor to be here both for both of you. Thank you. And Jason, always good to see you, brother.
Yeah. Likewise, my friend.
Thank you.
So Rene, tell us this. I've heard you speak about the information age versus the age of attention. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I think it's think about it from this perspective. And I think all the listeners here would probably relate to this idea where we have ideas that we want to share and we have things that are life and death. I mean, safety. I mean, we're talking about saving your life. That should be the thing that captures our attention. And yet, you know, people talking about let's eat healthier. That should capture our attention since it's the number one killer of what's killing us. But yet it doesn't for some reason. And so we are talked about being in the information age where everything's a click away. And now we've got AI, which, you know, our thinking now is taken on a whole nother level. But when we think about this idea, I know so many people with great ideas, people with life-changing solutions that nobody knows that they exist. And this is beyond branding, by the way. Branding is one form from a mass perspective, but how about somebody just in a meeting of 10 people and they have an idea, they have a solution, and they can't get anybody to listen. You have a family that you want to influence, you have children you want to influence, and they for some reason not listening to you. You have a spouse that isn't listening to you. And when we think about that jail cell of knowing you have something to offer and no one hearing it is really hard. And you kind of mentioned that sort of, you know, nobody paying attention and, you know, selling a product, nobody buying. The lack of influence is one of the most difficult of human experiences. And for me, one of the things that drives me is saying, okay, I was that guy that had great ideas that nobody would listen to. And so I spent the majority of my life figuring out what is it that I'm missing, number one. Why is it that some of these mediocre ideas get heard? And sometimes even the bad ideas. I mean, there's some people with really horrific, horrible ideas in this world. I'm talking about evil plans that for some reason people listen. There's got to be a science to this. And that's what really struck me. And in my years of working in environmental health and safety with people like you and other major corporations, that's what they've come to. Say, Rene, how do we get people to pay attention? And that to me is really where it's at. Information's at our fingertips, but what are you going to do with it? And which of all of this information we have, what are we actually going to hone in on? So that's really what I'm referring to.
And, you know, what we referenced, what we opened with, that's directly from your book, Amplify Your Influence. And, you know, you could open that book with anything, and you chose that particular frame. And we're going to talk a lot about frames today. You chose that frame of every frame that you could have. Why that frame to open what I believe is your first book?
Because I wanted people to think beyond sales and marketing and persuasion and the typical offensive strategy. I wanted people to realize that influence is a much deeper thing. If I'm working it at work and I'm able to bring an idea to work and people pay attention to it, I'm happier at work. I mean, it really is that simple. And it sounds so simple, but it is the crux of it. If I can bring an idea and I feel like I have influence at work, now my life feels better. If I don't have influence, I hate my job. So let's say that you're running a safety meeting and no one pays attention or they gloss over. Nobody says, hey, we're having a safety meeting. Not people say, God, thank God, I can't wait for that. And that is where the problem lies. There's a branding issue. There's a structural issue. But also inherently in the problem is the problem. There's a great book called Change or Die. And it was written years ago. I read this when I was literally just starting, like 1999 or something like that. It was when it first came out. And it talked about this study, and it happened at this conference called the Global Innovators Outlook Conference that IBM puts on every year. And they choose a very specific topic and they bring the best thinkers from all over the world to talk about it. And in this particular year, they were talking about healthcare, which at the time was a $2 trillion budget issue. And 80% of that $2 trillion was consumed by 5 behavioral issues, which we all know. If I were to quiz you, you'd get them. Smoking, drinking, eating, not enough exercise, and too much stress. So it's not a know-how issue. It's like, and this was 20 some years ago, maybe longer than that. We know that these are an issue, but yet it still happens. And so the CEO of Johns Hopkins at the time gets up there on stage and he says, we did this study to test this out. Because we said we took angioplasty patients, people that, you know, basically have their clogged arteries. They have to cut open the chest cavity, crack open that chest and you know, roto-root your veins, basically. One that's completely reversible. Just remember that. It's reversible with diet and exercise. Two, the surgery just alleviates some of the pain. So they said, well, maybe we need more motivation. Maybe that's the motivation. How about the ultimate motivator, change or die? So that they wanted the highest point of leverage. They're on their recovery bed. Doc sits down in front of him and says, Mr. Johnson, you almost died. He says, yeah, I know, Doc. He says, well, here's the reality. If you don't change how you eat and you don't exercise more, you will die. Should be the best point of leverage. Well, 9 out of 10, 90% were back within 2 years for a second surgery. Now, remember, that's reversible. So that moment, so they studied, okay, why didn't that work? And the reason is that we far too easily go into denial around the idea of death. There are so many, I mean, if you look at even just from Dr. Dan Ierley's books on predictably irrational and all of the study on irrationality and the things that we're actually scared of versus things that actually kill us, they aren't on the same list. The things we're scared of, the odds of us dying from that are slim to none. But the things that actually kill us, we don't even pay attention to. We're in complete denial of those. And so we look at that, we go into denial about death. And so we go, okay, so Dr. Dean Ornish, who's working with the University of Omaha and the Mutual of Omaha and University of San Francisco, they knew there was more involved in the change process. They knew there was a values component, a spiritual component, an emotional component, you know, and of course, logic, you know, all of those things, credibility component, all those things that went into it. And they took a different approach. Imagine this on their recovery bed, a daughter walking in with 2 grandchildren in hand. And they say, Dad, wow, we thought we lost you. And we were really scared. Of course, the dad's going to be tough and say, you know, honey, you know, I'm strong. We're going to be just fine. Well, Dad, do you remember when I got married? And he's like, of course I do. One of the greatest days of my life. Said, Dad, you know, I was so nervous that day. And man, I wasn't sure if I was doing the right thing. And then I remember looking at you and you just looked at me and you smiled and you winked. And the moment you did that, I knew I was going to be okay. Of course, the dad gets emotional. He said, no, honey, you know, I love you. Going to make me cry. And the daughter says, well, Dad, I didn't share that story with you to make you cry. I shared that story with you because if you don't change how you eat and how you exercise, you won't see your 2 grandchildren get married. That study produced 70%, 7 out of 10 were not back after 3 years. And so when we're talking about the real change issue, truly capturing people's attention, it's not logic, it's not statistics. It might catch an instant, quick little dopamine hit, which subsides really quickly. But if we're talking about really lasting change, you got to go at it from a much deeper perspective. And we've got to be able to capture people's attention and, like you said, capture their hearts.
And Renee, just to add, you know, Dale Carnegie had a very interesting statement he made about that. He said, we'd like to think we are dealing with creatures of logic. Really, we are dealing with creatures of emotion. Filled with prejudice and pride, all these kind of things. So emotion has to be a part. But Renee, sometimes we veer away from that. Why are we afraid of emotion?
Well, because I think emotions also at the core of some of the biggest challenges we have. I mean, emotions are, especially if you're looking at men, let's just talk about men for a minute. Men are not incentivized to feel emotion because, one, our best and most successful selves are ones that don't follow into emotion. And so the overuse of emotion is where you get school shootings and you get people to get in fights. And so that's the inability to regulate emotion. And so then now the one that doesn't feel any emotion at all is a whole nother problem. And so we were also taught as kids, as men, to say, okay, you know, big boys don't cry. It's all, you know, it's society driven and all of these things. And so, and our friends were great to remind us if we had any level of emotion of just how weak we were. And so it was ingrained in us not to feel it. And then you get also on top of it, business is supposed to be thought of as a for-profit enterprise. And their emotions really don't matter. It's A plus B equals C, 1 + 1 = 2. Let's follow strategy and let's get this done. Women have also been disincentivized in the workplace to feel emotion. Women feel that they lose credibility if they're too emotional. And they feel like, you know, so they have to adapt more masculine personality traits, which are known to be much more successful at work. And so, you know, when we talk about that masculine, feminine sort of personality trait, I am more of a feminine personality trait. Even though I'm 6'3", 250 pounds, I am a very agreeable person. I'm easy to get along with. My wife, who's 100, well, I'm not going to say her weight. She's very, yeah. Very skinny.
Watch out there. That's dangerous.
I've almost lost my life there. But she's in phenomenal shape. She's a beautiful woman. And yet she's way more masculine in personality traits than I am. So we have her negotiate for us. And so in those pieces, that's what the balance is out. So when I'm talking about masculine and feminine, don't get caught up in man versus woman. Just be clear on that. But we've been disincentivized to feel it. And then people haven't been trained in how. It's not always about crying. It's not always about this overabundance of it. But emotion might be just triggering a sense of realness. And truly what we're trying to get at is the connection to our values. So why did that second study work? Because we're more motivated by the fear of something, the fear of loss around something valuable. Grandchildren, that is so tangible to me. Like, I want to be there for my grandchildren. I'm not going to be around. And that immediate thought of, I only have a few summers left. I better get my stuff together is a really profound way of getting at it. We did this I think I can share this now, Cargill. They came to me about their safety strategy. And their president of one of their business units was saying, Renee, we want to, you know, they came to him and they presented the plan, which was to have the CEO speak for 10 minutes on video, which, by the way, CEO is extremely, extremely credible, runs an incredible business. And he's like, there's no way this is going to achieve what we want. I'm not saying anything against the CEO. He comes to me, he goes, Renee, what would you do? So we looked at this and we said, okay, what's the objective? So we want to create a video to capture people's and to announce the new 20, whatever year it was, safety strategy. And so we took and we outlined sort of the brain. Everything we do is based on neuroscience. And we said, okay, well, let's take a look at this metaphor of the sequence of the brain. Well, we have to create, you know, we've heard of the triune brain theory, which, by the way, is a debunked theory. That's why it's just a theory. But it's literally inaccurate, but metaphorically a very accurate way of looking at the brain, where you have the lizard brain or the croc brain, what people want to call it, the reptilian brain. We move into the limbic system, which is the mammalian brain, where we have emotions finally. You know, the reptilian doesn't feel emotion. They're like reptiles or cold. Then we move into mammalian brain, which, you know, teams and values and emotion. And it's the gateway to long-term memory. Then we get into the neocortex, which is the part of the brain that makes us human. And then in the prefrontal lobe, which is sort of the CEO executive center. So we mapped out those pieces and we said, okay, so if we know that we have to create a sequence here, we have to appeal to the reptilian, we have to get to the limbic system, to get to the neocortex, to get people to feel inspired. And those we follow for four questions. Reptilian says, am I safe? Right? How do I create safety, structure, order, predictability? Second one, we said, okay, well, what's the limbic system? Well, now we get into an open loop system, which means that there's interaction. I say something to you, you send something to me. So this brain says, do you care? Third brain, the human brain, says, is this interesting? Okay, does it keep my attention? If it's not, it's boring. I'll put my attention somewhere else. The fourth is this inspiring? Safety, caring, logic or data, engagement, then inspiration. It doesn't start with inspiration. That's the part that people miss. If you don't have these other pieces checked off. So we said, okay, how do we cut through the noise on this one? And what we came up with three stories of deaths that happened in a manufacturing site. And we wanted those people that experienced it to tell the story. But we were had a problem. They weren't actors and they were not good on camera. These were operators. They lived in manufacturing sites. And so we said, okay, why don't we break that story down? And I took all three of those stories and I broke it down into basically card size, you know, statements. And we gave them cue cards and we put the camera. So it shined right above, right under their nose. So their eyes weren't on camera, but right below their nose. And they were holding each cue card and they would say, you know, it was May 15th, 1998, whatever it was, next card. I was walking along, just minding my own business. And we heard the, you know, level five alarm go off. Instantly, I knew exactly what that meant. Next card was a death in the facility. And this person is going through this stuff and there's music playing that kind of matches this. So we're using, it's another form of using emotion, by the way, is using music. And so you're watching this. It's also using the challenge of attention, short attention span. So we create a lot of open loops, which mean an unfinished concept. It's one little phrase at a time, which forces you to dig in. That's why comic strips work so well. You have to follow each box. And so we did that and we followed three stories. And by the end of the 10 minutes, you had an entire audience in tears. And now you have this, the CEO gets up there, the head of the safety strategy gets up there and says, you know, now that we have your attention, we want to roll out what we want to do to avoid creating another story. We don't want to create another story. And so it was just a very different approach to truly capture attention, utilizing emotion in an appropriate way and a way that still is functional for business, because we know that it's one, it's an expensive piece, so it is good for business. And two, people's lives are at stake. I mean, those are the two big markers we're looking for. So lots of things that you can do with that, and those are one strong example.
Mm. And so tell us a little bit about this, Renee. You know, oftentimes, and I believe it's always well-intended, you get a senior leader for a big organization, they stand up and they share some version of a cliche, you know, safety first, or our people are our most valuable asset, or we want to send people home in the same condition in which they came. And I believe you call those cliches, and I've heard you talk about qualifying the cliche. And so share a little bit about the impact if we share a cliche, the potential impact that can have on people versus the beautiful example that you just shared that used framing a message, sharing a personal story, and then tying it down or driving action. Talk about the difference of what that does to the audience or the listeners.
Well, one is to have the self-awareness that what I'm about to say is cliche. And we'll just go back to the number one skill set required for this to even work is you have to have some level of self-awareness or really good people around you to point out that's a cliche. And so once I've identified it's a cliche, that doesn't mean you can't use it. It just means we have to use it differently. And where you talked about the tool qualifying the cliche. What does that mean? So the reason we need to identify the cliche is one, we can predict something. Then we get into the predict, preempt, prevent, 3 P's. It's another tool you should be using. Well, I can predict that people aren't going to pay attention to a cliche. It's not going to have much impact. Hey, the apple doesn't fall too far from the tree. People aren't going to go, whoa. No, we've heard that before. And I love the ones you just said, you know, hey, people first. Oh my God, I've never heard that before. World-class service. What? Drop mic. No, it doesn't work that way. It just has no impact. It's like we have a callus to it. So if I know that, why in the world would I say that is first question you got to ask yourself. If you know it's not going to have any impact, why would you say it that way? And so we go, okay, but we need that concept to live because we do want a quick word that to remember something. Well, you want a word to remember an experience, a story, a message, a value, a strategy, but you don't start with the word. You label it afterwards. You have to create the feeling first. Right? So it's very similar to, you know, branding. And we'll talk about that in a second here. So we go, okay, so what's qualifying a cliche? Let's just say I'm talking about world-class service. So I can say, guys, we want to offer world-class service. Great. So do we. So in a way, qualifying the cliche on that, you could say, guys, I'm gonna say something that I know is cliche. But I want you to hear what I mean by this. And what we're shooting for is world-class service. Let me explain to you what we mean by that, though. And now all of a sudden, stops them. I acknowledged that it was a cliche. I did a pattern interrupt, if you want to call it that, to get them to rethink a new neural pathway. Because it's like you have these ruts in the brain, and a cliche is a rut. Just goes down that rut, easily got that one. You say it's that rut, but hold on a second. This is me to what I mean by that. Forces those neurons to come back and say, okay, tell us what you mean. Now I'm really more, I'm engaged in what's happening. And so you're talking about, you know, give me one of the other ones you said.
Yeah, I mean, the safety first is the most common one. The other one that's most frustrating is we want to send people home in the same condition in which they came, which if you were in any other business and you sent people home in the same condition, you'd be out of business within a matter of hours. Doctors, therapists, chiropractors, dentists, you name it. And then the other one is our people are our most valuable asset, which I know you've heard that one a time or two.
So let's go with the send people home in the same way.
Yeah.
And this is a story. You've heard me tell the story of Jesse Arbogast. And so Jesse Arbogast was 9 years old at the time. And he was swimming with his uncle in the Florida Panhandle. And he was with his uncle swimming on the shoreline, or taking a nap on the shoreline. Jesse's swimming about 3 or 4 feet of water. And his uncle wakes up to hear this gut-wrenching scream come from the water. His uncle looks around and sees Jesse flailing about, surrounded by a pool of blood. This is a true story, by the way. So his uncle runs down as fast as he can, grabs Jesse, only to realize that a 6-foot bull shark had bitten Jesse's arm off. And he grabs Jesse, rushes him back to shore, hands him to his aunt. They apply a tourniquet. And for some reason, his uncle turns around and goes back in that water, finds the shark, wrestles it to shore. State troopers were able to kill the shark, pull the arm out, put it on ice, and give it to the doctors. And they have full function of their arm today. Mm. And so now, I don't know about you, but I did see Jaws 3 in 3D, and it's the last thing I want to do. Reporters got to the uncle, and they said, why did you do that? He said, because that's my nephew, and I promised his parents that I would return their child in the same way that they entrusted him to me. And so now, tie down, if I'm in front of a room, safety room. So why do I share that? Because our families, the families of the people that work for us, are trusting us. They're trusting that people can come to work and they're going to come home. If somebody's a school teacher, you expect the parent to come home, the husband to come home, the wife to come home, the child to come home. Well, it's no different here, except the difference is that we've got life-threatening, completely dangerous materials, machines, everything that easily could take a life. And in fact, it's taken 16 in the last 30 years. And so we have a couple options where we can say, yeah, safety first. We get it, check the box, and move on. Or we can remember, and this is going to depend on where you find yourself. I can't make you do this. But you got to ask yourself every single day, do you feel that that's your job, that that's your mission? Or are you going to allow it to play the role of a cliche where it goes in one ear and out the other? Are we going to look at our coworkers? And maybe you're upset at somebody and somebody's not grabbing out. They're not lockout, tag out. They're not doing the right things they need to do. And we just don't say anything. Or are you going to stand up and be courageous and say, you know what? And point it out. Because those are the things. And so when we say we want to bring people home in the way they left, that isn't just a phrase. It is what we do here. So you see, like using the story to then open the audience up and then you drop that message. And then you make it mean something at the end of the day. You could even go further. So the reason I share that with you is because, you know, let's say we're going to be measured based on this. So yeah, it's not just a story. This is your job.
And Renee, there you go with another Dale Carnegie principle about communicating people to dramatize your ideas. He says, just to say the truth, like it is the truth. We want your people to go home. Well, but to make it the truth with drama, to get its attention and to frame it in such a way that people get it. It's critical because you're right. I would think you think so many people get so many messages after a while, they just get lazy when they hear cliches.
It just doesn't have the impact. It's like it's a check engine light. It's supposed to tell you to stop and go check something out. And at first it has a little blip. After a few days, a week, you don't even see it anymore. And that process is called habituation, where if there's no change in stimulus, the brain habituates that stimulus to a much lower brain function. It's like driving home on autopilot. You know all the roads, you know all the trees, you know all the things. So you go on autopilot, and you drive home. And we need to be able to do that because we can't be in what we call system two for everything. Where system two is where it takes, we're very focused in, a lot of attention, a lot of mental energy to calculate this problem. Sometimes we've got to drive on system one, which is autopilot, and just get home. And so there is a real function for it, but you know, especially as safety professionals and people that are trying to make an impact and save lives, it is incumbent upon us that we learn how our brains and your audience's brains work.
You know, Renee, there's so much out there. And for me, it's been the last decade or so where I've really caught attention of, you know, stories tell facts. No, stories sell, facts tell. Like this, just you continue to hear it and hear it and hear it. And we all know people who are brilliant storytellers. And then we know people like yourself. You do it as well as anyone I've ever met. You use story to make a point. Now, that distinction, I think, is one of the most important distinctions, because people hear, I got to tell stories. And then they get up there and they're like entertaining.
Yeah.
But it doesn't cause any change or any influence whatsoever. Tell us about the difference between telling a story and being a storyteller versus actually using story to drive change.
Well, I think we all know somebody who's a really good storyteller. And we also know people who just love to tell stories. And I immediately probably triggered inside of you of, oh man, is it one of those people? Because my time is about to be gloriously wasted. So the difference is only two things. They're only one thing, actually. The person who is a really good storyteller, we call them a good storyteller for the reason that at the end of that story, there's a lesson. There's something of value for me. You took me on this journey, and at the end there was a pot of gold, which would be some idea, a message, a lesson, a moral, and a piece of value. And I go, wow, it was worth the journey. And now that journey helped me remember this as well. So it serves a lot of purposes. The person who's a really good, that loves to tell stories, they don't use stories to deliver value. They utilize our time just to tell us a story. And at the end, we're left with this lost feeling of feeling like our time was wasted, realizing that that wasn't for us, it was for them, had nothing to do with me, didn't move us forward. And so people forget that storytelling is a tool. It's like saying, well, I swung my club today. Where'd the ball go? I don't know. Well, I don't want to play with you then. I'd like to play to swing this club so it goes towards that pin and inside that hole. If you're playing golf, there's a purpose to it. It's not just swinging the club. And so the tool is one of the clubs. Swinging it is telling it. Where it goes is whether you added value or not. And if you go nowhere with the story, it's a waste. And so we have to be able to, and the transition and the phrase that we use, and you just mentioned, you alluded to it, is this concept called a tie down. And at the end of the story, we want to meet that story at the end and be able to say, the reason I share that story with you is this, or what that means to you is this, or what that means to our 2024 strategy is this, what this means to you today and what we're about to go do tomorrow is this. So we get really clear, the story, this energy, this message, it really means this. It's that it's even further than the message. And the more you understand your audience, if the audience, let's say that there's, you know, their safety record is in the red, it's, they're not doing good. So then, and we know that that's sort of underlying what's going on. And that's the most poignant thing. I might tell a story and give a message and everything, but really at the end of the day, what this really means, if we don't adopt this, we will not change this important metric. This is our fastest way to make that change. So now it dives to this. If a child gets in a fight at school and you tell the story about that and you end it, so, but let me tell you what this means to you. If you don't fall in line, you won't be at the school anymore. Got it. It wasn't just a story. The story was, so I heard that message, right? And so there's all sorts of things that you can utilize it for, but you have to remember the story is the vehicle by which, it's like a boat going across the river. What are you putting on that boat? It better be something good. And if you wait for the boat to come there and there's nothing there, you just watch the boat come across and you're like, okay, I could have done something else with this time.
Tell us a little bit about, so there's really one thing, and then I want to transition into regulating emotions. And the reason I want to transition into regulating emotions is I think we've all been there where we've prepared logically for hours. And we have a big presentation, whether it be in front of 10 or 1,000 or whatever the audience is. And we get up there and then the mind just goes blank. And so first I want to talk, or actually I want to get to regulating emotions. So I'm just going to put that one out there. But I want to first touch on this book called Hook Point, How to Stand Out in a 3-Second World. Mm-hmm. Because I think one of the most frustrating things for safety professionals, so many of our listeners, is in reality, they're getting swiped or scrolled by and they don't even know it.
Yeah, I think you're referring to Brandon Kane, correct, in his book, Hook Point. Yeah, really, really well said. Smart idea. And so what it applies to us, he wrote that for a social media world. So that basically the reason why people don't do well on social media, and this is what, when we made the transition to understand this 3-second rule, was, you know, we grew over 1 million followers on TikTok. And I think our new account went to 211,000 followers in less than a year. So there's a real application of that. But I want to go deeper because I also find a lot of people probably listening aren't big on social media. And I don't blame them. A lot of business professionals aren't. It is a way to get a hold of people, but I think we need to think about the idea from this perspective. What I had to learn was there's a difference between a captive audience and a non-captive audience. And that was the first underlying piece. I was using tools that I teach, and you've been through the course, which are really designed for a captive audience, meaning you can't scroll me off stage. You can't swipe me off stage. You're stuck with me. Now, you can mentally scroll. Like, you can be looking at me thinking about something else. You can look down at your phone and be scrolling other things. Like, that's a way of just dropping your attention. So there's a reality to that. But when you are in a captive audience, you can use things like a frame, story frame, to begin a conversation. You can start off by saying it was May 15th, 1961. And Alan Shepard sitting on top of the Redstone Rocket. And you can use a story. If I were to do that on Instagram, I'd be gone. If I get on Instagram and I say, you know, I remember when I was a kid, it'd be gone. And the reason is, and I'll give you the best reason why. Imagine walking up to somebody you don't know in the street. And you walk up to, you literally, they're having coffee. And you walk up to them and you go, I remember when I was a kid. They would look at you like, who in the hell are you? Leave me alone. I'm having coffee. Now, that's in an in-person environment. We're doing that on social media because they're having coffee scrolling. And I go, I remember when I was a kid, they're going, and they do this with their thumb. They just scroll, get out of here. I don't need, no value. So when you think about it in a social media world, it's a 3-second audition for attention. And to an audience that has no idea who you are, they don't know your credibility, your credentials, what books you've written. They know nothing about you. Now, people that are known with big brands like Tony Robbins or Gary Vee or, you know, whoever it is, you don't have to follow the 3-second rule because you've already been hooked by them. The brand is already there. You see their lips moving and you try finding the audio button because you want to hear what they're saying. The rest of us aren't that way. And so now it's, okay, we have to capture that attention. So now to do that live, because I'm assuming I can go down the route of the formula for social media, which I'm happy to go with. Maybe we can talk about both, but there's also the formula for in person, so you don't get mentally scrolled. How do you stop getting digitally scrolled versus mentally scrolled? How would you like to approach it?
Yeah, I think for this audience, let's focus on the mentally scrolled. Okay. I think digitally scrolled, you have so much good content out there, whether it's TikTok or YouTube or Instagram or, of course, the book, which if for people, and I'll say this unapologetically probably 15 times, you got to get this book, whether you think or whether you are driving change and influence or whether you're struggling with it. This is the book for tools to make sure that you're driving change in your organization. And I know you talk about that in here, Renee. So let's focus on the mental piece so we can make sure that we're delivering for people in person.
For sure. Thank you. And so I'll just do the last keynote that I did. I was in New York City 2 days ago. And we had, it was me and all the celebrity real estate agents. So Ryan Serhant and Josh Altman and all the ones you see on TV, the Million Dollar Listings and Dina Goldentire, like all of the ones. And then me, I'm the opening. And so one, I have a captive audience, like a really captive audience. They're sitting there with their eyes open, pens in hand. So my brand showed up to that event before I did. That's the power of personal branding. And so what I tell people is imagine having 2,000 foot soldiers out there that know your calendar and they show up to every meeting saying, hey, do you know Jason? Wait till you see this guy speak, man. He's awesome. He's real. He's entertaining. This guy is just committed. He cares. And then people, just 2,000 people telling you in an audience this before you show up. And how is it when you show up after that? You're showing up walking on water. And then those 2,000 people stay after your meeting to say, I told you. Wasn't that awesome? That's what the role that your brand plays. Now, what's interesting is that I get a lot of, like my Cargill folks and the 3M, a lot of people come to Amplify to work on their leadership brand, not their personal brand, their leadership brand. And so I did a lot of work the last 3 years on, okay, what's this leadership brand thing? I mean, I understand the conception, it kind of makes sense, but it's really simple. What kind of leadership do people expect from you when you walk into a room? And so I thought, that's interesting, because I know some people that, you know, Sonia, who's one of my dearest clients, when she walks in a room, you better have your diversity, equity, inclusion language in check, and you better be on point. You better be inclusive. You better be all of those things. And she also runs a $1.4 billion business unit. She's also smart. She's phenomenal. In fact, the perfect email in my book was her email to me. And so she is as good as they get. I know certain people that when they walk in a room, you better have a sharp pencil and your numbers exact, not approximate numbers, because they're going to ask you. One of my mentors, 27-year mentor of mine, coach, I know that every meeting, she's going to remember the last promises I made her. It's so annoying. She doesn't forget anything. And so I expect that level of leadership. When she walks in a room, I better have done my homework and remembered everything that I promised. Those are leadership brands. And so if you develop your leadership brand, because some people have leadership brands that those 2,000 foot soldiers are out there saying, hey, Johnny's about to be here. Just take everything he says with a grain of salt. He's not organized and he doesn't follow through. And importantly, he's done a couple of, hey, Johnny, come on in. That audience is already primed with that brand. It's not the brand we want. And then they stay afterwards like, see, I told you, right? A lot of talk, no action. People have brands whether they want them or not. And we need to really understand as leaders, and that's what I was talking about, the safety. You're also dealing in a world that's no different than used car salesman. Used car salesman triggers immediately sleazy, slimy, not honest. What does safety meeting trigger? Boring. I don't want to be here. A waste of time. Whatever that unfortunate brand is, which is why I love your work, which is why I said yes, because it's so critical that we reestablish that brand so that people say, hold on a second, this is part of my work. That takes a very different approach to do that. And so if you're going to be in a captive audience and you don't want to get people to mentally scroll you, you better share a story. I'll tell another story, which had somebody who runs he probably has 15 mechanic shops and 15 mechanic shops. And he was in our course and we couldn't get him to tell a story. I was like pulling teeth. And he's like, I'm still processing. That was his way of saying, I'm not going to tell you a story. And I just used the word named John. It was actually Rich. And I said, Rich, I said, okay, your presentation, you jumped right to metrics and why they're all using the wrong metrics. I'm trying to help them. They're all following the wrong metrics. I said, great. I said, but why aren't they listening? You're here for a reason. He goes, well, they just all think I'm just trying to line my pocketbooks. I said, well, you haven't filled that gap for them. And if you haven't filled the gap, they're going to lump you in to every other business relationship that they've had. And you're dealing in a car shop. If people say, I'm going to a mechanic, people don't say, great, I can trust them. Most people don't understand how cars work. Most people get charged more than what they feel like they should. And maybe they aren't, but it feels that way. And so no wonder they don't trust you. And I said, you got to tell your story. All these guys know these are mechanics. These are wrench turners. They don't want to hear a story. We got a hold of his partner and he said, Rich, he goes, I spend the majority of my life telling people your story so that they listen to you. And it kind of hit him hard. And we finally got him because the question was how much of the story, because he had stories of bankruptcy. He had stories of checks bouncing. He had stories of almost losing everything. I mean, all of these stories. And he's like, well, which one? I said, well, I said, do you use salt on your food? He said, yeah. I said, why don't you unscrew the top and pour the whole thing in? He's like, well, does that be too much? I said, yeah, not tolerable, right? I said, well, that's what it's like when you tell too much of a story. I said, why don't you just eliminate the salt altogether? Well, that's dull and dry and boring. I said, yeah, well, that's what happens when you don't tell any story. But if you use just enough, as much as necessary, but as little as possible is the metric, which is a subjective one, which takes time to master and people around you to help you. As much as necessary, as little as possible, you can engage and change someone's life. And so we went through it and we chose a couple pieces. One story he told a little deeper. The other ones he spent about 15 to 30 seconds on. And then he said, so the reason I share all that stuff with you is I don't want you guys ever to feel like you can't cash your checks. I don't want you guys feeling like, you know what, I don't know where the next customer is going to come from. I don't want you to go down the path I went. That's why I'm talking about metrics and all these boring things. It's not to line my pocketbooks, because if we have a down year, you guys still get paid. If I have a down year, checks don't cash. And it was just a totally different way of approaching the same challenge.
And did he see that, Renee? Did he see it once he tried it?
Oh, 100%. He's going to be delivering it this next week. But we were on the phone, we designed it out, and it finally clicked for him.
So here, Renee, are safety people. They're doing their thing. They're trying their best. They're dealing with workers one-on-one, dealing with upper management. What kind of advice do you have to them in this, just in this particular area of story? What would be your challenge that you'd have or recommendation?
So when I'm assuming that they work with people that let's get more specific on the challenge. Yes. on their challenge they're facing. Are they not listening? They're not being heard? They feel invisible? What's the specific challenge?
My thought is that they've been around these people. These people know them. It's not like the first time they're meeting them. and they've lost their edge. They say, I can't get these folks to listen to what I've got to say. They take me for granted.
Yeah. So you think about it from this perspective, it's, they've got to be able to. So when you talk about that, there's so many different approaches. I'm going to give you one.
Yes.
I look at that as almost entitlement, the same way I would approach an entitled group, right? I'm trying to get them to change and they're stuck in a certain way and they won't do that. Well, first, the leader has to own that entitlement was created by them. Like, I allowed the movement. And that is also what makes this approach feasible. So if I'm, let's say I'm talking to my group that, of people that work for me, might start with, it's my fault first. That's what we call it, my fault first. Mm-hmm. And before we start this meeting, I need to apologize to everybody in this room. I need to apologize because I have done such a poor job of expressing and capturing your attention and also really expressing the importance of what we're doing. And if I were you, I wouldn't blame you. I don't know if I'd listen to me either in the way that I've been doing things. And so one, I have allowed us to underperform. I have allowed us to not meet our standards. I've allowed this to happen. And so we need to, and I need to take the next part of this meeting to reestablish the mistakes that I made. Mm. And we need to come together to do this differently. And so in that sense, if you're in a sales group, you take advantage. I've allowed you to underproduce. Let me get clear on the requirements to be here. So now, let's say that I'm the leader of the group and I'm supposed to get engagement, but yet I have no authority. Well, there's an inherent problem there. You can't give somebody responsibility without authority. And so let's say I've got this group and I don't have the authority. Then I go to my boss and I say, you know what? I failed you as well. I failed you in the sense that I have not included you in on this and not made you a part of this because I don't have the authority to threaten somebody, put their job at risk, put something in the file, and I don't have the support that I need because I didn't express to you what I needed from you. And so I've also probably done a pretty poor job of expressing just how important this is. So that's one approach where you can take, and the reason you start with my fault first is you're reducing any set level of attack versus you need to be in that meeting. You guys need to pay attention. And you know, no, you guys aren't paying attention. I'm trying to do my job and no one shows up to the meetings and I do these things. You don't even read my emails.
Oh, that goes over like a lead balloon. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. Cliche. Bad. But that is a Carnegie principle. If you're wrong, admit it quickly and emphatically.
Absolutely. And there's nothing wrong with it. But now if you follow it with what the need is, that's the key. There's a really cool sequence that I use when it comes to that stuff. It's the sequence is empathy, transparency, then authority. And it follows how the brain works. And so let's pretend that, you know, COVID was happening and people are scared. So I start with empathy. Folks, I understand that right now is a tough time. I know it's scary. We don't know. We're supposed to wear masks. Do we come to work? Do we do 6 feet? When is this going to end? I get it. It's hard on our families. Transparency. And quite honestly, I don't know when this is going to end. And unfortunately, I've also allowed myself to fall into that rut of being worried. Authority. But I do know this. No matter what's going on out there, we still need to show up and give our best every day. We still need to follow all the safety principles. We still need to service our customers and give maximum value. And as much as all this other stuff's going on, I know that's the one thing that all of us here in this room can count on. So empathy, transparency, then authority. Mm-hmm. And if you start with authority, though, guys, we need to show up better for our customers. We need to do this. We need to do this. And we need to be able to. They're not even hearing it because all they're worried about is the emotion. And so there goes the emotion again. You have to be able to squelch that emotion and be able to. And the way you squelch emotion, by the way, is acknowledging it. You just acknowledge it because what they want, they don't need adherence to what they say. They need to know that they've been heard. And if somebody feels heard, it closes the loop for the limbic system. Even if I say, I hear you, and this is what I'm hearing you say, I said, yes, thank you for sharing that. Here's the reason we can't do that. And they're open. And I know this from working with unions for so many years, that unions are just as good a business people as anyone. And a union, is their job isn't about getting their way. That's what people think. The union is to make sure people are heard. Hmm. And when people get heard, you'll watch the union when they know they heard. They say, you know what? We're business people too. We need to let go of 14 jobs. Okay, by Thursday we will have a list of people that we think would be our recommendations. We understand this too. We want everybody to have a job, and we know there's a bigger picture here. We thank you for sharing it, and they've been part of the process. We know who the entitled people. You think they don't know who the entitled people are? The ones that are lazy, the ones that aren't pulling their weight. You build a relationship with a strong union, they will hold people accountable way more than management ever could desire to. And so it's I use that whether you're union or not. It's just a way of saying that people, when they feel heard, they feel valued. That's a limbic system connection. They will jump on board even if they can't get what they want. They at least know that my voice was part of this. And so it's a really big piece to really help people understand that.
You know, Renee, I referenced prior regulating emotions, and I've been through your course, Amplify, multiple times. And, you know, to frame up for people, I've been the perfect student. Everything you said, I was doing my best to capture every single word, word for word. And I'm taking notes, and in my head, I'm prepping. This is what I'm going to say when I have the opportunity to address the audience and the other participants. And then I've got up there in the course itself, which is as safe as an environment as you can imagine. There's a literal conference room with 8, 10, 12 other people, and my mind goes blank. And I was like, when I was sitting there, I captured everything Renee was saying, and I know exactly what I need to do, but when it counts the most, when the pressure is on, I can't perform. Yeah. In this moment, I can't perform. What is it about regulating our emotions? Because everything you're saying is effective, no question. The challenge, people are going to try it. They're going to stand up and their mind's going to go blank. Their palms are going to get sweaty. Their voice is going to quiver. Tell us how you can regulate your emotions, no matter how high the stakes are in any situation. How would people do that?
Well, let's acknowledge why it's happening first. You're learning a new skill set. You're growing. And what I've come to learn is that awkwardness is a requirement for growth. You can't avoid it in the beginning. And learning how to ride a bike, it's awkward. Standing on stage for the first time is awkward. Changing the sequence of and telling a story when you haven't told the story is extremely awkward. And if you expect to master it the first time, I got news for you. It's not going to happen. Babies didn't walk the first time they did it. We gave them how many chances? As many as it took. And so we think about these new skill sets. One is to reframe the fact that me freezing on stage is part of the process and saying, okay, now that's just biology. I am stressed. Why? Typically, it's because we want to perform at our best level. Why do we want to perform at our best level? Because we want to be impressive. There isn't a single person on this planet that doesn't want to be impressive if they're in front of a room. So by definition, inherently built into this thing is this pressure to be impressive. And so what I learned, one is a couple skill sets. One is you have to learn breathing. Breathing is the secret weapon of any high performer. Look at any athlete, a Navy SEAL lives and dies by box breathing, 4 seconds in, hold 4 seconds, out 4 seconds, hold 4 seconds. And they repeat that process. Why? Because it brings oxygen to the brain, because you control process, and it reduces the emotional response. That's our system two. They get to system two. System one is that sort of autopilot, freak, panic, primitive side of us, what everybody else is in, which is what happens. And on system one, we don't have access to memory because we're very present in the moment. We're only looking to the end of our fingertips, our blood vessels constrict, and we do that. So we know that when that's happening, it's just a part of the brain that's turned off and one that's turned on, and we got to reverse that. Breathing is one of the fastest ways to get your parasympathetic nervous system to get back versus your sympathetic. And so, one, at first it's going to be awkward. Be okay with it. In fact, embrace it and love it. And if you're awkward at something, that means you're growing. It's really a beautiful thing. The second thing is when people go through the first time, there's so much stress through the process that they usually have that experience, and then they have time to practice, and then they come back a second time and they're like, I'm going to kill it this time. And what happened? Who is that really for? I'm going to kill it. So my audience loves me. First of all, who doesn't? I got a stage coming up with 12,500 people. I got some of the most famous people in the world I'm going to be there with. I want to kill it. And damn it, I better be careful with that phrase between now and then. And if that phrase follows me on stage, I already know the outcome. It's not going to be good. I have to be able to go through and let go of that need to be impressive and get back to being expressive, meaning share my story, share what I've learned, share the lessons and follow the sequence, connect to the audience and be a servant on that stage, not a recipient. I am there to serve. And the reason I have to be a servant is because they have an option to cancel me, to scroll me, to say that was not good. So my credibility is not mine, it's the audience's. And when I realize that it's not mine, it's the audience's, and I move into a servant on that stage, it changes your whole physiology.
Huge. Mm. Huge. Well, Jason, we have heard so much here. I mean, and Renee, thank you for talking to us from your heart and giving us real ideas. Renee, if we're to wrap this up now, for those safety professionals that are facing challenges, facing situations, well, from what you've learned about dealing with safety people who are on the front lines, what's a word or two of encouragement you'd give to them?
Great question. I would say this, that like doctors, like police officers, like social workers, very few of them entered for fame and glory. And I guarantee you, a safety professional didn't enter for fame and glory. You enter because you actually care. And you're in a thankless business, which is really hard. Because when things go well, it's as if you don't exist. And when things go bad, all blame falls on you. It's a tough, noble position that you've taken. And I would venture to say that it's also not an easy one. So I would tell you this, if you really do care, if this is really why you're doing it, then I urge you to figure out why you got in this place the first time. What was it? What were the stories that really moved you? What were the things that really, why is it that you're in this? And learn how to tell those stories. Learn how to tell them in a sequence that captures attention and in a way that is just enough. And by the way, at first, you won't be good at it, and that's okay. I don't want you to be. You shouldn't be. Unless you're already good at this, then you know what? You're going to take it to the next level, and then we have higher expectations of you, which is great. But now, if you're not good at it at first, that's okay. Do it a few dozen, hundred times. You can get a lot of practice in 3 months, in 6 months, in a year. And you know what? We overestimate what we can do in a year. But too many of us underestimate what we can do in 3 to 5. Mm. If you're 30 years old, be a pro by 35. If you're 40, be a pro by 45. Take that 5-year approach to master the skill of capturing people's attention and being able to deliver the message. I promise you, you will feel happier. Doesn't mean you won't enjoy any accoutrements along that 5-year journey. You will. Every month you'll get better at it. It'll get better and better. But if you think about it from that long-term approach, you will be able to truly affect lives in a way that most of us will never notice. Just like a lighthouse. People see that light, they avoid the rocks, and they keep going. But they're so grateful for that lighthouse.
Renee, thanks so much for joining us and giving people guidance, coaching, you know, tangible and tactical tools where they can truly be the lighthouse for the people, for the workers, for the senior leaders, for the organization, so they can take their organizations where they know they can, and not so they can just, and we talked about this, send people home in the same condition, but so they can actually send people home in better condition. Mm. And I'll close with this. There's a beautiful quote from your book, and it says, "It's not my responsibility to listen. It's your responsibility to make me want to hear." Mm. And everything that you've done since the day I met you gave people the ability, the confidence, and the courage, as we've referenced multiple times, to be the type of person that people want to listen to, right? So their messages can be heard, not for the intent to be impressive, right? But for the purpose of being expressive, so they can move things forward within their organization. Renee, it's always a pleasure, man. Thanks so much.
Awesome. Appreciate it to both of you. Thank you for doing what you're doing and bringing this modern approach to a such needed discipline around safety. And you guys are the lighthouses. You guys are doing the work that will not be thanked as much as it should. I hope that you know that and keep shining brighter.
Jason, Renee comes across in a way that makes us stop and think. I took 5 pages of notes, just scribbling as fast as I could to get everything. One thought that really stood out was his idea of you have to break the mold. Unfortunately, as safety professionals, like with the safety meetings, the common complaint is boring, same old, same old. He said, break the mold, do something different. Not to impress, but to capture the attention so they hear the message we've got to say. Vital idea.
So good. And it is, you're right on, Merle, vital idea. I didn't quite get to 5 pages of notes because, you know, I've known Renee for about a decade. And I've got the book, which we referenced multiple times, Amplify Your Influence. You know, I did take about 3 pages of notes in preparation and then another 2 pages today. So I did get to 5 notes thanks to the prep. But I think I want to build upon what you said. You know, what Renee gives us today is he gives us tangible tools where we can step in to a position of influence, whether or not we have the authoritative title. That's my biggest takeaway is influence is not about title. Influence is about intention. And Renee talks about not only some of the intentions that can get our minds right, one of them you just referenced, but additionally the tools that we can use to drive change within our organizations. I think today is a must listen. Merle, we went 60 minutes, we went hard, and that was about as full and as thick, right, as you can deliver that Renee did for our listeners of value in about 60 minutes or so. Beautiful episode.
So for everybody here, thank you for listening. The challenges you face, stop, soak in these ideas, words of wisdom. There are answers for all of us in directions that when we take that first step, goes a long ways.
Thanks for listening to My Big Safety Challenge, a podcast produced in partnership by Dale Carnegie and BCSP, with your hosts, Dale Carnegie, Master Trainer Merle Heckman, and Jason Koons, Global EHS Team and Culture Activation Lead for 3M. Executive produced by Charlie Eltringham, supervising producer and editing by Michael Escobedo. Directed by Michael Escobedo, Joel Bergai, and Giachi Liu. Graphics by Giachi Liu. Editorial support from Brendan Mohawk. Consulting producers are Colin Brown and Mark Sullivan. To have new episodes delivered directly to you, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever fine podcasts are downloaded. If you would like to share your story of a safety leadership challenge you faced, email us at info@mybigsafetychallenge.com. See you next time.